Readings taken from Isaiah chapter 4. Reading from verse 1. And seven women shall take hold of one man in that day, saying, "We will eat our own bread and wear our own clothes. Only let us be called by your name. Take away our reproach." Verse 2. In that day the branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land shall be the pride and honor of the survivors of Israel. And he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy, everyone who has been recorded for life in Jerusalem, when the Lord shall wash away the filth of the daughters of Zion and cleanse the bloodstains of Jerusalem from its midst by a spirit of judgment and by a spirit of burning. Then the Lord will create over the whole site of Mount Zion and over her assemblies a cloud by day and smoke and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory there will be a canopy. There will be a booth for shade by day from the heat, and for a refuge and a shelter from the storm and rain. Hand over to Phil.
Thanks very much, Alfie, for reading. Good to see you. Our subject today is the wonderful, permanent, new salvation that God is bringing about for his people in what he calls his New Jerusalem. I think I'd been a Christian for about 10 years, at least, before somebody showed me that the Bible was a story. I used to read the Bible in this way. So when I first became a Christian, I used to close my eyes and say, "Lord, please speak to me." And then I'd stick my finger in and there would be a verse. And I'd read that and then go off into the rest of the day. I was thankful 10 years later for someone explaining to me, no, that's not how to read the Bible. The Bible is a story. I wonder if that's something you realize. It is a story about God, an epic story, that makes The Lord of the Rings even, which is possibly the greatest epic, look like an episode from Coronation Street. The Bible is a story about God and what he's doing. It's about his plan to save a people for himself from sin, from death, from judgment, and to bring them to be with him forever. And that's where we are today as we look at this chapter. If you don't know anything about the Bible, and there may well be people here for whom that's the case, we're sort of plunging into the prophet Isaiah. Who is Isaiah? Well, Isaiah came to speak around about the middle of the Bible. So the end of Israel's history, Isaiah comes in, and here he is in the middle of the Bible story. And Isaiah is a hinge in this great story. And if you want my best summary as to what kind of a hinge Isaiah is and why God sent Isaiah, well, God announces two seismic shifts in the trajectory of his salvation plan at this point through Isaiah. Two seismic shifts. Number one, the shift from the old to the new. Number two, the shift from the you to the me. Let me try and explain that. So the shift from the old to the new. And we've seen this, and we were talking a little bit about this last week, in the way this section is structured. So chapters 2 to 4 of Isaiah, as we said last week, if you flick back to chapter 2, 1 to 5, we get this picture of the new Jerusalem. And then in chapter 4, where we are here, we get this picture of the new Jerusalem, and then everything in between is the old, this old world. And the point we saw last week is that the old is coming to an end. God is bringing the old to an end. In other words, Israel under the law is over. It's finished. It's failed, that covenant, because other people have failed to keep their side of the covenant. In fact, the whole world, God says, is soon coming to an end because of sin. And so, as we saw last week, there will come a time when this city, London, is long forgotten. Every great name, every great brand, every great organisation, every project, long forgotten. As we saw in chapter 2, the Lord has his day when he will rise to bring an end to this world because of sin. But God says through Isaiah, I'm bringing a new and permanent and better world for my people in a new Jerusalem. The nations will flow into this Jerusalem, as we saw in chapter 2. What will they find? They will find eternal peace, true peace, under the rule of God. So there is a shift from the old to the new. And secondly, with this, is a shift from the you to the me. If that's not immediately obvious what that means, let me try and explain. So the old covenant law, under which old Israel was all about the people's obedience. It was dependent on you, in other words, on the people, ultimately, to keep the laws of Moses. But they wouldn't and they couldn't obey. So, through Isaiah, God says that this new permanent salvation will now depend on me and me alone. I will do it, God says. The shift from the you to the me. And that is why Christians talk so much about the grace of God. I don't know if you've noticed that, if you're listening in to things. And that's why Christians sing weird songs about God. Almost sound like love songs to God. A new one I was listening to came out recently. 1,000 hallelujahs and 1,000 more. As if Christians are struggling for words to proclaim their thanks and their praise to God. Why? The grace of God. The shift from the old to the new and the shift from the you to the me. And my prayer is that we will see both of those things in this passage. Just look down at chapter 4. We learn three things about God's eternal city. Firstly, it will be a fresh new salvation through the branch of the Lord, verse 2. In that day, the branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land shall be the pride and honour of the survivors of Israel. The branch of the Lord, or more literally, the fresh new shoot of the Lord. Or as one commentator puts it, the sprout of the Lord. I'm not quite sure why they translate it branch. I guess because it must become a branch. But the word is a fresh new shoot. And the picture is of a fresh new shoot emerging from the rubble of Israel after exile. We've had chapter 3, the end of Israel declared. Chapter 4, the picture of a fresh new shoot, a sprout emerging from the rubble of Israel that will grow into a glorious inheritance. The point seems to be God saying, I'm doing something new. After exile. Yes, it will grow out of the soil of Israel, but it will be a fresh start, a new work, new roots. The law of Moses, the old covenant, has run its course. The curses have fallen on the people for their sin. And now God says, chapter 4, I will bring a fresh, new salvation after exile. Notice it will have small beginnings, therefore, the shoot of the Lord. Almost missable to begin with. But it will grow into, did you see there in verse 2? It will grow into an inheritance to die for. The envy of the world. The pride and honour of God's people. But the picture seems to contain a sense of tiny, unimpressive beginnings. So I don't know if you've ever been to Kew Gardens. No one goes to Kew Gardens, though, to see the tiny shoots just poking up from the soil, but they go to see the trees. And in the same way that the picture seems to be here of tiny, almost missable, unimpressive to the world beginnings, a fresh new shoot, but with massive endings, a glorious inheritance, the pride of the people of God, the envy of the world. And notice as well that this fresh new salvation, how will it be brought about? It seems entirely through the branch of the Lord. When I first read this verse, I assumed that the fruit of the branch constituted the people of Israel. So that perhaps the branch was the roots and the people would be the fruit. But if you look carefully, that's not what it says. The fruit of the land shall be the pride and honour of the survivors of Israel. The people are the spectators. The people watch on. They watch the branch of the Lord sprout and grow into a great salvation for them. And then they punch the air with celebration as the beautiful branch of the Lord becomes their salvation, their inheritance. And just another thing to note. Remember that chapter 3 last week, the people of God, the daughters of Zion, what were they doing? They were seeking beauty for themselves and glory, beautifying themselves. The nation of Israel pictured as trusting in man in order to beautify and glorify themselves apart from God, in rebellion against him. And God says, you can't have it that way. I'm taking it all away. But, chapter 4, verse 2, I will give you the beauty and the glory that you want beyond your wildest dreams. I will do it through my branch. I will do it. Think for a second, the glory we sinfully seek in this world apart from God. God says, you can't have it that way, but you can have it. I will do it through my branch. Who is this branch? Well, secondly, washed forever by the Lord, because in this fresh new salvation, God's people will be washed forever. Did you see that in verses 3 and 4? He who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy. Everyone who has been recorded for life in Jerusalem, when the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and cleansed the bloodstains of Jerusalem from its midst, by a spirit of judgment and by a spirit of burning. How will the inhabitants of Jerusalem be called holy? Verse 3, holy forever. Well, verse 4, when the Lord shall have washed away their sin. See, the law of Moses exposed sin, didn't it? That's what the law of Moses did. But it couldn't remove it. God's people, declared by Isaiah, no better than Sodom after all these years under the law of Moses. What is the lesson of Israel? The lesson of Israel is that they could not do anything about their own sin. Do you remember? Chapter 1, God says, "Ah, my people, laden with iniquity." Animal sacrifices, the temple system, could not wash away sin. God says, chapter 4, "I will do it once and for all, and then my people will be called holy forever." But can I say, this is an utterly game-changing moment in the Bible story. From the old to the new. From the you to the me. I will do it, God says. Actually, if you know the Bible, story, the problem that has plagued humanity from the very start is sin. Sin came in. Death had to follow. But if sin is washed away, well, then the possibilities become endless, don't they? Life, eternity, in God's presence. God says, I will do it. Notice how he will do it, verse 4. How he will do it through a spirit of judgment and by a spirit of burning. And so there must be judgment, God says. There must be judgment. Judgment must fall on someone for your sin. But I will wash it away. I will do it. We should notice one more thing before we move on, and that is that God's people in the New Jerusalem, I don't know if you noticed this, God's people in the New Jerusalem will be a remnant, verse 3, he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem. What do we make of this? Now, of course, this remnant was pictured in the Assyrian invasion. And as Assyria came up to the neck, came up to Jerusalem, and God wonderfully rescued his people in Isaiah's time, and there was a happy remnant of Israel left in Jerusalem. But I suggest that that must be pointing to a greater reality. This is about God's eternal new Jerusalem, his eternal people, all who were recorded for life, right? And so therefore I suggest as well that it's referring to a sobering truth. And the truth is that though Jerusalem will be filled with people, chapter 2, an international city, innumerable from the nations, an uncountable number, yet still they will only be a remnant of humanity. The point seems to be that the majority, Isaiah suggests here, will not find salvation from God's judgment. The remnant of humanity will emerge, washed, cleansed, safe in God's city forever. Many years later, Jesus would say, "Wide is the road that leads to destruction, and many will go there. Narrow is the road that leads to life. Only few will find it." And can I suggest it's not surprising, therefore, that being a Christian in this world feels like being in a remnant. In the city, in your workplaces, are the majority there professing faith in Christ in your workplaces? It feels very much like being a remnant, doesn't it? Yes, we pray that many in this city would find life in Jesus Christ. But Isaiah seems to be saying that when all is said and done, though the offer is for anyone, for everyone, those in the end, found in Jerusalem, washed forever, will be a remnant of everyone who's ever lived. So a fresh new salvation in which God will wash away his people's sin forever. And thirdly, he will wrap them in his presence forever. Verses 5 and 6 come as a result of verses 3 and 4. Did you notice that? Because they are now holy, because they are washed from sin, therefore, verse 5, the Lord will create over the whole site of Mount Zion and over her assemblies a cloud by day and a smoke by night, a shining of a flame fire by night. For over all the glory there will be a canopy. There will be a booth for shade by day from the heat, and for a refuge and a shelter from the storm and rain. It is impossible to overestimate the beauty and the glory and the significance of these verses, can I suggest? This is the happily ever after ending of the Bible story. The one that every Disney film is trying to find. The imagery is very significant, and it is all about God's holy presence with his people. I've put on your sheets there a verse from the book of Exodus. It's actually the last verse of the book of Exodus. It's the climax of the whole story of that part of the story. And it says, Exodus 40, verse 38, "The cloud of the Lord of hosts was on the tabernacle by day, and fire was in it by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel throughout their journeys." The cloud of the Lord and the fire of the Lord in the tabernacle. This is the climax of the old Exodus. It symbolizes God coming to live among his people, the holy God, in the tabernacle. The cloud and the fire. But verse 5 here in Isaiah, therefore, is talking about the climax of the new Exodus. But a better Exodus, right? Can you spot the difference? Might be a while since we've played Spot the Difference. But perhaps we can try and spot the difference now as I read verse 5 again. "Then the Lord will create over the whole site of Mount Zion and over her assemblies a cloud by day, smoke by and shining with flaming fire by night. For over all the glory there will be a canopy." Do you spot the difference? It will be over all the whole site of Mount Zion. In other words, the whole of Mount Zion, the whole of God's new creation, will be like the Holy of Holies in the tabernacle. God's unfiltered, glorious, holy presence with his people. No barriers. The Old Testament temple was pointing towards a day when God would be able to live barrier-free with his people. It's like being back in Eden again. This time it's permanent. Do you notice that? No moving around, no lifting off like wandering in the desert, but the permanent home of God's people. God's dwelling with his people forever. Okay, but there's more. Because his presence is not only close, but also intimate. And it's easy to miss this detail, but I think it's a really important detail. Just look again at verse 5, where it says, "Over all the glory there will be a canopy." That word canopy is a very specific word, meaning bridal canopy. It's only used two other times in the Bible. One in Psalm 19, to describe the sun coming out of its bridal chamber. And one in the prophet Joel, where he says, "Let the bride leave her chamber," canopy. In modern Jewish weddings, it is the thing that is symbolically held over the bride and groom during the ceremony, canvas, to represent their new home together. In the film Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which you will all remember very clearly, it's the end, it's Maid Marian finally getting hitched with Robin Hood in the outdoor wedding, the canopy over the bride and groom. Now, if that was just one word, we might overlook it. But remember that this is in the context of God describing his people like a woman, chapter 3, chapter 1. Pictured empty and naked on the ground. Here, in the final consummation, through this fresh new salvation, here are his people, pictured like the bride of God, tenderly wrapped in his presence, as a husband might wrap his arms around his bride. Way back in Deuteronomy, at the beginning of Israel's history, God described his people as his treasured possession. "Out of all the peoples from the face of the earth, I will take you to be my treasured possession." He couldn't have her through the law of Moses. She was filthy with sin. Finally, through this fresh new salvation in his eternal city, God will have his people as his treasured possession, his bride, holy, washed forever. And did you see verse 6? They will be so safe in his protection. No harm will ever come near them. No more judgment of God. Perfect peace in his presence. And if we're Christian here today, this is the hope of every Christian. The happy ending. Well, a fresh new salvation in God's new Jerusalem. Washed forever, wrapped forever, And God says, this time, I will do it. The you to the me. I wonder what you make of all this. Well, I think if we're Christian here today, a number one conclusion, what a wonderful God. If you're Christian, you have found this salvation in Jesus through faith in him. And I hope you might be able to take some time to pause and to say to God your Father, as you go back to the office, thank you, I praise you, I worship you for what you've done. That you didn't leave me in the shame and judgment that I deserved. Chapter 3. But you have become my salvation. You may have the question, if you're perhaps not a Christian with us, you're seeking, you're looking into things, you may have the question, what's all this got to do with Jesus? And if that's you, well, come and ask me, or in the question time, or speak to any Christian around the table and they'll be able to help you. One day, this city will be gone. All of the brass, all of the projects that you're working on, forgotten, every career. Where do you want to be in eternity?